Peter, please, you have the floor for giving us advices, suggestion, whatever, please.
Thank you, Manfred. I want to get three quick points out of the way before I get to the subject at hand. First of all, I want to thank Annabelle Dwyer for her invitation to send me to jail. And I want to assure Annabelle that I have been to jail as a result of demonstrations against the Vietnam War and the bombing of Cambodia. On the other hand, I agree with Van Vandenbeesen that people who have reached their 80th birthday, as I have recently, are in a position to turn over some of those obligations to people under 35. Secondly, I want to honor somebody in our presence today. Peter Becker talked about that remarkable and hugely important German decision on both the right of conscience and the illegality of the Iraq War. And the judge who wrote most of that decision and convinced his fellow judges to go along with it is sitting right there. And it's Dieter Dijsselroth, and I think we owe him a great debt. And thirdly, I want to give you a piece of good news from the United States. That's an unusual thing these days. But the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States last year in the Hamdan case is also a hugely important decision in favor of international law. It has, as usual, been misread and misrepresented by the press as dealing only with the question of whether Congress has to approve the military commissions that have been set in place by the administration. That is an important part of the decision. The more important part of the decision, because of its reach and its effect on future cases, is the reaffirmation by the court that Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention applies to all persons captured in the course of armed conflict, and that therefore the position of the United States that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to the people in Guantanamo is absolutely wrong. And that was a 5-3 decision. And there is language in that decision that upholds the primacy of international law over the kind of gobbledygook that we have been getting from the administration about national security trumps everything. So every once in a while, you know, there's something to applaud, even from the United States. Now, for the subject at hand, I want, first of all, to thank Alan for the massive job that he has done, job of research that has produced the kind of information that all of us working on a return to the court or thinking about it will be able to use. On the other hand, I have to say, yes, and I want to say in passing, by the way, that this is not an official, what Alan has distributed is not an official Iolana document, because we have not had a chance in Iolana to deal with it. But I do very much appreciate what Alan has done on it. I agree with Jackie that if and when we go back to the court, we have to do it in a manner that will prompt diplomats at the United Nations to go along with it, that will explain clearly what we're doing to public opinion, and that will be likely to result in a favorable outcome. And I think the way to do that is to focus on the failure of the nuclear weapon states to even begin to comply with the general good faith obligation that was unanimously put forward by the court at the end of its opinion. And by the way, what they did in that was remarkable, in that that general obligation was not even addressed to the question, Fon, right? Fon said, what the court does in an advisory opinion is to answer a question. Well, they did answer the question about illegality, but then they went on and said something that wasn't asked of them, because they felt so strongly about it. And they talked about the general obligation to pursue and bring to a conclusion. And those words are very important, because they were added to the obligation that already exists in Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Article 6 says there is an obligation to negotiate in good faith for nuclear disarmament. And paragraph F of the final statement of the court added the words, and bring to a conclusion these negotiations. And it also added the words, in all of its aspects. In other words, not just nuclear disarmament, which could mean going down from 30,000 weapons to 20,000 weapons, but they said nuclear disarmament in all of its aspects, which is Aesopian language, if you like, for total nuclear disarmament. So my view is like Jackie's, that should be the only question asked of the court. It is not that the other questions that Alan mentioned are not important, but they have two disadvantages in my view. One is that they are complicated and therefore will lead to a lot of discussion back and forth among countries inclined to go along with a resolution asking for an opinion by the court. And perhaps more importantly, that they will serve to delay for a very long time what we are all asking for, and that is the commencement of negotiations. You know, if we ask the court, what is the law on power sharing? Well, I mean, on nuclear sharing, not power sharing, nuclear sharing that Alan referred to. The court may say that's a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it is. And then NATO, you know, may want to look like they're doing something about that. They're going to negotiate about it for 5 or 10 years, and eventually they may do something about it. And in the meantime, the principal objective will have been pushed into the background. And the principal objective is to get the damn negotiations started. Right? Now, we have a nuclear weapons convention that we can present to the countries, if they ever get to that point, not as something to take or leave, but as a demonstration of the fact that negotiations for nuclear disarmament in all of its aspects are possible, and that a positive outcome of those negotiations is possible. It certainly won't look exactly like the convention which we in civil society produced after 3 years of work, almost 10 years ago now. But it will put to the lie the point made by diplomats for nuclear weapon states that this is such a complex problem that there's no point in even starting on it. So that's my view. And I'm very much in favor of going back to the court with that question. I think probably more so than Jackie, who you've raised some important questions, whether this should be the end-all and be-all of our activities in the foreseeable future. My answer to that is no, it shouldn't be. But I think it could be. I think the process of going back to the court could be a rallying point for the movement. And I certainly think that a favorable decision from the court, namely one saying clearly the nuclear weapon states are in blatant breach of their obligation to commence negotiations in good faith, will be a further impetus for the movement. And that's all it will be. And, you know, one of the things I agreed about with Stephen Haynes yesterday is that no matter what the court says, the nuclear weapons countries won't pay any attention to it. And we have to be aware of that. But what they will have to pay attention to is the rising movement of the people of the world to be rid of this terrible thing hanging over their heads, which, as I said yesterday, is not only the threat, the possibility of a nuclear exchange, whether by intention or by accident, killing millions and millions of people, and, you know, not to mention the environment and so forth, but also the fact that nuclear weapons have now become the justification for war. So, yes, I think we ought to go back to the court. I think we should start, as soon as this conference is over, to begin to discuss how to do that. There's one other reason for going back to the court. And that is the decline of law in the world, the decline of the respect for law in the world. One of the lawyers who appeared in the 1996 case for the United Kingdom, Philip Sands, has written a book called Lawless World. It came out last year. And it's a terrifying book to read. It's about what Judge Wiramontri in his writings has called the long millennial climb toward a world of law which is now in danger of being reversed. And so when you have something as important as the general obligation clause in the 1996 advisory opinion, which is just being discarded, disrespected, ignored by the countries to which it is addressed, it adds to the general disrespect for international law in a world in which power seems to be the ultimate be-all. I think we're running late in our program, and I want to end with a quote also, Jackie. I want to associate myself with a quote from President Bush. President Bush said, "We must keep the most dangerous weapons out of the hands of the most dangerous people."